Welcome back to the program as we turn our focus to urban life. For those of us that love cities and often claim to love their authenticity and their soul, oftentimes we're the ones that want the gentrification, the new galleries, the new coffee shops, the new boutiques, those things that make neighborhoods look alike and that cause neighborhoods sometimes to lose their authenticity. How do we balance the two? How do we reconcile convenience and modernity and the authenticity that we love about cities? We're going to talk about this morning with my guest Sharon Zukin. She's a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's the author of the previous books Loft Living and Landscapes of Power. It is my pleasure to have her here to talk about her newest work, Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places. Sharon Zukin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. We do have this dichotomy for those of us that love cities and that we claim to want them to be authentic, to be interesting in terms of their neighborhoods, and yet we tend to move towards wanting them all to look the same.
This is exactly the problem that my book, Naked City, deals with. We're seldom conscious of how our desire to consume interesting places and interesting foods and interesting people actually exerts a lot of power, both financial and cultural, that displaces those people from the very places that we admire.
And of course, the real estate market, as you talk about, is another big component of this because it impacts the value of these neighborhoods.
Absolutely. Despite the drastic effects of the current economic recession and mortgage foreclosures, we still see that property values are rising dramatically. And these are the property values that reflect a lot of the interests that we have in interesting spaces. These interesting spaces, however, soon lose out to the higher rents that can be paid by chain stores, whether they're Starbucks or H&M or Dunkin' Donuts, of which we have more than enough in New York City.
Isn't part of the problem that you constantly have young urban professionals that move into these newer neighborhoods because they are more affordable and then want all these conveniences and all of these things that we're talking about?
It's not just affluent urban professionals who exert this cultural power to change the neighborhoods that they like. It's also artists who have very low incomes, but who are often graduates of art schools and certainly have a very highly developed sense of what's interesting and what's aesthetically interesting to them is aesthetically interesting to a much wider public. It's the media, too, and, you know, I'm not blaming you. I'm not blaming the wonderful journalists whom I love to read, but the media create a much wider hunger for the same sorts of pleasures of the city that an initially small group likes. And then through a lot of media attention, more and more consumers come to these spaces and create the financial vortex that sucks up the original interesting places.
Is this a 20th, 21st century phenomenon, or has this been going on ever since there have been cities?
Well, I'd like to know what happened in ancient Rome. It could have been the case. I think a lot of it has to do with our contemporary real estate markets. And don't forget, in the United States, in contrast to other countries, even in Europe, young people have had the opportunity, both cultural and economic, to get their own apartments away from their parents or their traditional birthplaces. So we have a lot of mobility, a lot of residential mobility that feeds into real estate markets. I'm sure that this is a common problem in San Francisco, the Napa Valley, as well as in the center of New York City.
And talk about what happens when it goes too far. I mean, we all remember the conversations that took place in New York back in the 80s, particularly with regard to Times Square and the arguments of kind of Disneyfication.
Absolutely. When this kind of interesting development goes too far and big real estate developers, often the government too, get involved, we have a homogenization, a standardization of place that brings in the chain stores so that every place looks like every other city of the world.
Are there cities that you've seen that have successfully balanced these two needs? One, this sense of gentrification and the desire to bring some of these urban aspects to authentic neighborhoods, but that have still been able to maintain their authenticity.
I think we also have to ask about the moment in time when a balance seems to have been struck between authenticity and modernization. Maybe Barcelona has been able to keep the center of the city looking and feeling diverse while also encouraging a lot of modern new construction and development. But you have to have a city government that is very serious about keeping low-income people in place, very serious about keeping local stores, mom-and-pops, in place. And really, it's the local officials, the city council members, the assembly district members, who have to keep a line on small, local, authentic space.
Is there the economic reality, though, for those small mom-and-pop stores to exist in today's climate?
This is a serious question. Small business owners are always in a very vulnerable position. But I believe there are some small stores that have a good future in the city. Interestingly enough, some of these small stores who deal with the needs of local residents of different income levels and different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, a lot of these new owners are artistic and creative entrepreneurs. The trouble is you have to keep a balance between the old and the new authenticity.
Talk about it in terms of shifting neighborhoods, because one of the things that goes along with everything we've been talking about is the way neighborhoods are consistently changing and moving around, and what happens to them over time.
Well, that's absolutely true. Some people have told me I'm crazy to write about authenticity in cities because cities are constantly tearing down and rebuilding the way they look. But I think about a neighborhood like Greenwich Village, where I live, which has managed to keep small-scale buildings, which house rent-stabilized tenants and also small mom-and-pop stores for years, despite an early 20th century move toward tourism and gentrification. Again, I think there have to be very conscious efforts by community groups and by local officials to keep local residents and stores in place.
This has been going on long enough, though, that there are now neighborhoods that are going through their second and even in some cases third wave of gentrification.
Well, that's true. I guess tomorrow's gentrification is yesterday's fear.
Or today's gentrification is tomorrow's authenticity.
That's true also. That's true. I'm not trying to hold back change. And in fact, I look at several neighborhoods in Naked City that represent new and very interesting forms of authenticity, but not by affluent groups. For example, I talk about the Latino food vendors at the ball fields of a waterfront Brooklyn neighborhood just around the corner from the new IKEA store. Mm-hmm. These vendors fought the bureaucracy of the city government so that they could remain in the ball fields selling pupusas, empanadas, tacos, all the foods that they have brought with them, which are now enjoyed half by a Latino group of consumers who come to play soccer and half by new non-Latino residents of the city who just enjoy the food.
Mm-hmm. What overall impact has this had on people coming back to cities and kind of the reurbanization of so many people that moved out to the suburbs years ago?
I think that the most important condition which we need to mention is the dramatic decline in crime rates in all American cities, especially in New York. It's a safer city that attracts people in the first place, and then it's the more interesting places that the city has created. But most of these places are small scale, and they arise because of the creative and the entrepreneurial efforts of all kinds of people, new immigrants from other parts of the world, as well as people who migrate because of the arts and culture.
What about those cities that had gone into somewhat of disrepair, and that it was a broad-based gentrification that really brought them back?
Well, I think we have to be careful about the very interesting term that you use, broad-based gentrification. We use gentrification maybe haphazardly these days. What we want to have is redevelopment, but at prices that all residents can afford.
Talk about that.
Well, it's very difficult to mention certain words politically these days, like rent control. Not very many cities in the United States have rent control.
Right.
And in these times of drastic mortgage foreclosures, it might seem ridiculous to talk about rent control, but foreclosures and rent control are two sides of the same problem. We have to keep people of all income levels in the places where they can really find work. We have to have an impetus for creative entrepreneurs to set up shop, whether they're selling to artists or whether they're selling to a much broader public. It's this mix that makes a city authentic. And again, I think it's local officials, it's community organizations who have to work together with tenants, with homeowners, and with small retail business owners to keep these activities going.
To what extent does density play a role in how these things happen?
Well, I do have to say that the environmental movement and government action on the environment are moving all places to desire greater density. It's this density that allows cities like New York or San Francisco to recreate themselves for a new, broader public. And it's this density, I think, that will save cities in the future.
And yet you see some of the same things happening, the same issues that we've been talking about, in parts of Los Angeles.
Well, absolutely. There's a problem of encouraging capital investment. This is always difficult. But you can educate investors to desire density, to desire diversity, to be part of a really vibrant mix. I'd say capital investment is the first hurdle that authenticity has to confront.
How do you reconcile the capital investment and the motives that are behind that with some of these issues that we've been talking about?
Well, you're completely right, because developers are often of two minds and two wills when it comes to appealing for government subsidies to build and government permissions, zoning variances, but also trying to maintain a good reputation with the public, so that we have some developers who in one part of the city may refuse to fund a project that would pay workers a living wage, while in another part of the city they're promising to provide affordable apartments. I think that developers have to be educated. Maybe a younger generation of developers would be more receptive to an education that talks about authenticity in terms of social equalities.
What about those newer cities that have essentially driven out to a large extent all but maybe the artists and those young professionals? You think about a city like Seattle, for example.
Well, Seattle has been fairly successful in maintaining authentic parts of its core and maintaining a diversity of residents. I think you have to have a very aware city government and representatives of districts that push to maintain diversity and small scale.
How can government effectively do that, in your view?
Well, I'll sound as though I'm going back to an earlier period of time if I say government has to make laws, government has to impose limits on what developers can build. Government has to keep people in place and prevent them from being displaced.
And to the extent that government can't do that, talk about what happens.
Well, if government can't do that, we wind up with overblown real estate development or deserts of disinvestment. It's hard to walk the fine line where you please investors and you keep low-income people in place. I understand that. I think everybody understands that this is one of the major problems that cities face. How can they stay diverse while encouraging development?
And in trying to find this balance, talk about how difficult that is within the political process from what you've seen.
Well, representatives understand that city governments are not in the business of building, at least not in the United States. If you go to other countries, smaller countries, like the Scandinavian countries, for example, the governments have no problem with limiting what private developers can build and where they build it and what sorts of facilities they must include and how to mix residents of different income levels. Here in the United States, I think city governments have to become more activists. They have to take a major role in defending the city that is so that they can build the city of the future.
And how is New York, by and large, done in that regard lately, do you think?
Well, New York has a very mixed record. No matter who the mayor is, the mayor confronts the very big purses and big egos of real estate developers. And this has been a very hard road for any mayor to travel. The City Planning Commission, in particular, in recent years, has advocated the values associated with the great urbanist Jane Jacobs: neighborhoods, the ballet of the street, small merchants, small scale. But these are the very values that push gentrification. And the difficulty in New York City is that the city government has advocated for big projects while not keeping an eye on the small neighborhoods where ordinary people need to live.
And in some cases, though, haven't those neighborhoods kind of taken care of themselves, that the market has really dictated, and sometimes in a very positive way, what's happened with some of those neighborhoods?
Well, the market, as we all know from the current financial crisis, can go wild with exuberant overinvestment. So I don't think that cities can afford to depend on markets.
When you look around the country, do you see cities that have gotten it right more often than not, and there are those that are kind of best cases that we should look to?
Well, when you look closely at any best case, you can find the chinks in the armor. some cities can do things well because they continue to attract new people with new ideas, whether they're rich people or poor people or people broadly in the middle. So I'd say that any of the big cities, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, continue to do some things right because they can't help themselves. That diversity will not die.
Sharon Zukin, the book is Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Sharon, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff. It was great.